And we welcome Richard Fitzwilliams. Governor Richard, how are you?
Oh, very well indeed. The London Film Festival continues, ending Saturday with Stan and Holly. And, of course, it's been quite a royal week, as you know.
Yes. Tell us about the film festival. Have you made your presence felt there yet, Richard?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. It's been quite a, you could say, royal couple of days, because I saw The Outlaw King, the film about Robert the Bruce, Chris Pine and Aaron Taylor Johnson yesterday, and then this morning, The Favourite, which, as you know, with Rachel Weisz and also Olivia Colman as Queen Anne, is one that's definitely going to feature come the awards.
Yes.
Lucas Guadagnino's Suspiria, what happens when someone who normally makes brilliant films turns to horror.
How big is the London Film Festival in relation to Cannes and other ones around the world?
Well, it's certainly grown. I mean, that one can say. There's no question there is a small awards, but it hasn't got probably the cachet of Cannes. But then Cannes is, as you know, the business side as well. And also Cannes has been going for so long and Cannes gets so much more publicity. What it has got, and I mean, I think we've seen here at the BAFTAs, British films and British talent, they're seen so many in so many places, also technicians and so on. And with our film industry, whether or not it makes a fortune, that has always been debated, but the profile is higher than it was. But obviously, Cannes is pretty unique. And of course, you know, in Venice, in Berlin and so forth, I mean, these are festivals that have more reach, I think.
Well, the reason I ask is here in Marbella, they have a film festival, which I think has just finished recently. And that's growing as well each year on year. But it's such a... it's a difficult market to break into when you've got established festivals, and also there's only so much time in the year, of course.
And also, this is going to be the problem when the Oscars are moving backwards. When that happens, all the other award ceremonies that had been, as it were, linked to the Oscars or attempting to influence the Oscars, they'll move back as well. So we'll have to see. I mean, there's so many film awards as well, because, you know, you've got the Empire Film Awards, you've got various magazines, you've got the Emmys, you've got the Grammys and so forth and other. It's almost as though I don't think there's an excess of them, but there's no question, if given the problems that the Oscars are facing, the fact that they're cutting the ceremony to 3 hours, the fact that they're not going to be screening up all this is what is intended, the technical awards, the fact that they're seeking for categories to make it more popular, all that's rather desperate from a ceremony that apparently got, I think it was 57 million to watch Titanic, and indeed even 30 plus million in 10 years ago, and is down now to 26 million. So, I mean, this is something that has been taken very, very seriously by the Academy. So it's a battle. I don't think Cannes is affected by this because of the business aspect as well as the different categories. And, of course, there are those films in contention for the Palme d'Or, and it's the out of... the on a certain regard and various other categories and so on, and then of course they screen reissues, and it's huge. I think London is very different, but what they've tried to do firstly is enlarge it, and secondly, there's no question they get a very substantial number of stars, but it's not, I would say, at the Cannes level.
You're also, you're saying there about the royalty, royal correspondent as well, Richard Fitzwilliams. So what's your take on, it's been massive news, and I was talking to somebody from the Daily Mirror this week on the show, and he was quite amazed by just the popularity of the royals over the last few years and how newspaper coverage has really exploded when it comes to royal stories over the last 2 years.
They couldn't have more of it. There couldn't be enough of it. Absolutely. I mean, it's phenomenal news. And let's face it, I mean, it is, because it's the world's most high-profile royal family. We're in the age of social media. We're also in the age of selling newspapers, which means supplements, and supplements will satisfy the demand of readers for what they want to read about, and it seems that that is linked to Kate, it's linked to Meghan, and I would even say that Eugenie, who most people, well, a lot of people know very little about, 1909 to the throne, married Jack Brooks-Bank last Friday, but the facts are that nearly 4 million people tuned into that on ITV. That isn't a bad audience for a Friday morning.
I mean, you're talking about maybe near X Factor figures there for audience anyway. Let's talk about the... So anyway, just on that one, Richard, I mean, just if you want to give me an idea of what the name is so we can go and, you know, put a little bet on.
I'm sorry?
I wonder if you have any idea on what you think the name might be. Will it have Diana in the name?
I've been doing a bit of this. Sorry, I just didn't hear the... I may change my mind on this. Bertrand Russell, the famous philosopher, was once asked, would you die for your opinions? And he replied, certainly not, I may be wrong.
Yeah.
When it comes to a boy, I would say, why not Philip? Because it would be a wonderful tribute to Prince Philip, who stood at the wedding, although he did no stick at 97, which is extraordinary. I mean, it's just a thought. And I mean, Diana is the one that they're pushing, but it would be making a statement, I think, that would be going a little further than Harry and Meghan would intend, certainly with their first child. But I wouldn't be surprised if one of the middle names was
Diana. Yes.
I would suggest, how about the Queen is Elizabeth Alexandra Mary. So how about Mary as the first name? Now there's a say Alice, of course, and then there's Victoria, because Victoria's rather interesting, because 20 years ago regarded as a dour imperialistic frump, and now completely revived with films, television, fascinating documentaries about her. People are very interested in her. It's a possible.
I wonder if Queen Victoria would have known that her reputation would change as a result of Netflix. But anyway, talking about Netflix, this is a Netflix movie, isn't it? This first one, 22nd of July, and talking about Andras Breivik, of course, this film.
I have to say, directed by Paul Greengrass, and we know how good he is at Bourne Supremacy and the Bourne movies, Captain Phillips, The Green Zone, Bloody Sunday, the documentary or docudrama, and United Number 93, again, about the fateful third airliner hijack. I mean, what Greengrass has is this ability to make a movie very much as though it was a documentary. You know it's a docudrama, but he looks at things with, I hesitate given the subject, to say impartial. What he does is document, and then you respond the crimes of the most monstrous neo-Nazi who murdered 77 people, perhaps the worst crime in Europe of its sort since the Second World War. An absolutely ghastly tragedy. It's a film in English, interesting, because, I mean, Greengrass is English, and he was, since it's set in Norway, on the island, much of it on the island of Utøya, the children of the Workers' Youth League of the Labour Party were targeted, and 69 of them were killed, and also there was a bomb placed in the offices of the Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, which killed 8. It's an extraordinary movie because it documents what happened. And Anders Breivik wanted to make a statement. They realized he was a lone wolf. He wanted the end of immigration and an anti-Islamic statement. And it's interesting that the way he pleaded in the court meant that firstly they regarded him as insane, but that would have meant that he was institutionalized, not imprisoned. His change to a plea whereby when he knew what he was doing, well, which he most certainly did, he was declared sane, and then he's still in a solitary confinement. What this movie does, it's got this rather clinical quality, which is very gripping, but it has got one serious problem. Now, that's most emphatically not an excellent cast. Breivik himself is played by Anders Danielsson-Lee very, very well, and oddly enough, he wants a liberal lawyer because he knows that ethically his lawyer has to defend him. Mm. And Pierre Lippestad is chosen, played by John Oigarten, an extremely well-nuanced performance, because he has to balance his utter loathing of this murderer with the fact he's got to do his job. And we also have two other stories. Firstly, John's home life and how that's affected by him taking the case, forced to, more or less. And secondly, a victim, Vilja Hausen, played by Jonas Strand-Gravely. We follow him and we follow his decision to give testimony in the court. And, I mean, this is an extremely good film, but there's a rather unfortunate statistic that it cost $20 million to make and has hardly grossed anything at all, only $140,000. The problem, I think, is the length. It's 2.5 hours long, and several films, I've noticed, that the last four I've seen at the festival, three of them were 2.5 hours. And I do think that this is something that has to be watched. This clearly, I mean, the next film we're going to discuss is nearly 2.5 hours. It's quite a sit. And for this sort of material, which you could, in theory, see on televised form of drama or some such, and where it's thought perhaps that you don't need the larger screen. I don't agree, but nonetheless, that must be what people are thinking.
Well, I'm wondering, Richard, when you say that, in the days of Netflix and like TV series and the way in which society is going, people really like to maybe watch a series now, maybe watch an hour in their viewing in the evening, may not have time to do a 2.5 hours slog, you know. And I think that the film industry's got to be aware of that, that people are maybe, their attention spans aren't like they used to be, and all this, it's all there in the mix.
Yes, and in Twitter, in Facebook, you know, it's things are moving fast, as you say, and which is why, you know, this movie just hasn't been seen, and yet you would see, I mean, United 93 is famous, Captain Phillips is famous, Bourne is famous. It's one of these things, because it's got a lot of merit, it's got some very good performances, and as I say, there are several human stories being told, including one where a human turns out to be a monster.
Okay, well, ratings out of 5, Richard, please.
I'm definitely 4.
Lovely. Okay, so 22nd of July, watch that film, and I think you've got to be in the mood to watch it, and 2.5 hours as well, that's probably the issue there. It's not a feel-good movie, is it, of a Saturday evening?
It's certainly not that. In fact, it's absolutely chilling, because the massacre sequence is about 20 minutes, and seeing these children shot, I mean, it's horrible.
Hard to watch. Moving on to Bad Times at the El Royale.
Bad Times at the El Royale is one of these rather curious movies. It's part art house, part attempt to appeal beyond that, though it too hasn't done terribly well, and it too is 2 hours, 20 minutes, and it too, in my opinion, is too long. But the better news is that although, and a lot of these films annoy me, where you actually have a movie which the director has decided to put a divide into segments. So you've got the El Royale is a hotel, and part of the hotel is in California, and part of it happens to be in Nevada because of the division of the states, and it's only got one bellboy. It's fallen indeed on hard times, and the film's is labeled Room 1, Room 3, and so forth, so you realize what's going on in there. Something that the management have been filming for a very long time, because there's not just the money from a heist involved in this movie, and it's a problem if you're after all involved in a heist and you suffer from dementia and can't remember in which room the money is in. It's rather a difficulty, which brings me to introduce the cast of people who happen to be staying there, and fortunately one of them is Donald O'Kelly, played by the excellent Jeff Bridges, and he gives a superb, rounded performance. As I say, he's searching for a lot of money, and he's got others suffering from memory loss. He's pretending to be a priest, which he certainly isn't. And there's also Cynthia Erivo as Darlene Sweet. She's a struggling soul singer. There's Dakota Johnson, who's Emily trying to save her sister from the cult of Billy Lee. He's a Manson-type figure, so you can imagine some of what's likely to go on. And there's John Hamm as an FBI agent. Now, this movie, it's a curiosity. Music plays a large part in introducing the different segments and in the different segments. And also you've got a very good cast of characters, especially Jeff Bridges, and you've got a lot of violence, and you've got a sort of... It has been billed as a neo-noir thriller. It's certainly unusual, and it's a bit of a curiosity. I rather enjoyed it, I have to say, but again, I would make the point that it does tend to be a bit self-indulgent. It's got the gimmick that what has been going on in all the rooms has been filmed by the management, and then, of course, such tape would be very useful for blackmail, not to mention the actual money from the house that's hidden somewhere in the hotel. The hotel, having, as I say, one person in it, is more... a rather garishly coloured, the colour is very important to enjoying this movie, excuse to insert certain characters in certain rather curious and very often violent sequences. It's quite good.
It'd be interesting to see what the hotel gets on TripAdvisor. But anyway, Richard, ratings out of 5 for that then, please.
Well, I mean, directed, produced, and written by the same. This often happens, of course, Drew Goddard. I go to 3 out of 5.
Okay. And Jeff Bridges is a class act, isn't he?
This is the reason for seeing the film. I would add that Billy Lee is played by Chris Hemsworth. I would also add that Chris Hemsworth doesn't have to do very much acting in the part, which is just as well.
Probably about as much acting as he did in Star Trek. But anyway, thank you very much, Richard. What are we going to be looking at next week?
Next week we've got a movie called Columbus, which has received a lot of acclaim, and we've also got the latest Michael Moore, Fahrenheit 9/11.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Richard. As always, if anybody wants to get you online, how can they find you?
Online at www.richardfitzwilliams.com and on Twitter at @RFitzwilliams.
Richard, we'll speak next week. Have a great weekend. See you soon.